You're with the Fifth Estate podcast from the Wheeler Center. In this episode, recorded on September the 4th, 2018, which was a fortnight after Scott Morrison replaced Malcolm Turnbull as Australia's Prime Minister, Sally Warhaft speaks with Guardian Australia political editor Catherine Murphy.
And of course, 2 weeks ago, well, the world was a slightly different shade of something than it is tonight. So it's just the right amount of time for everybody to have digested it somewhat and to have Catherine whip down from the national capital to just be with us this evening. Catherine's been a journalist in the Canberra Press Gallery for 22 years and is now political editor of The Guardian Australia and the author of this also, you know, and tenured little book on disruption. Again, perfectly timed by MUP for tonight's discussion. And it will be on sale, courtesy of Paperback Books, after the event tonight. You can get a miniature autograph. Please welcome Catherine Murphy. So just to start, Catherine, what happened?
Well, first of all, just the pleasantries. Hello, Melbourne. I love being in Melbourne. Hello. It's so delightful to be here. Now, what happened? Oh, my God. Well, where do you start? I was just telling Sally, actually, at the Canberra Writers' Festival last weekend, I had a number of questions about that, which I thought to myself, my God, if Canberra residents so hooked into the political process are saying to me at a writers' festival a day after the event, can you please tell me what happened, what a job Scott Morrison's got with the rest of the country to try and explain what happened. As best as I can explain what happened, it's this. I think there has always been an element of the Liberal Party that would not have Malcolm Turnbull on any terms and would not rest until Malcolm Turnbull was sort of run out of Dodge. So there's always been an element against the Prime Minister. I think the government on that score has had its options open since the beginning of the year. I think it came on a little bit more quickly than perhaps some had intended it to. But the catalysts were, in essence, let's just divide the government into two camps. Let's call one camp the plotters and let's call another camp the panickers. And there was a sort of meeting of the minds between the plotters and the panickers after the result of the Longman by-election in Queensland. I think before the Longman by-election, there were some in the government prepared to tolerate Turnbull on the basis that he might be a saleable figurehead to win them an election. And I think once they got through Longman and they worked out that they have a problem with their base, in essence that they are losing votes to the right and to political disruptors on the right, particularly One Nation and other populist figures, that Malcolm Turnbull was not a leader who could cut through and connect to that sort of rusted off constituency. So then panic started to bubble and it was sort of tangible. 3 weeks before we were sort of into full mayhem, I wrote a column pointing out that there had been what I described as an organic drift to Peter Dutton after the Longman by-election. And that was sort of predicated on the idea that we're going to be killed in Queensland and we need a figure who can cut through and save the government in Queensland. And various Conservatives were appealing to Dutton, really, to drive a political reset in the government. And then that gathered pace once Parliament resumed. And, of course, the hook for the blow-up was energy policy. and the National Energy Guarantee. Now, you can either say about Malcolm Turnbull that having two goes at trying to achieve a borderline rational policy on climate change and energy is either an act of great courage or an act of hubris, given his own people. I'm probably in the former camp rather than the latter. But anyway, Malcolm Turnbull gave them a coat rack to hang their outrage on by proposing a policy that some of them weren't prepared to stomach, because, of course, it involved a component of emissions reduction. So then we blew. The House blew.
It reminded me most closely to Rudd's ousting, in the sense that it you know, they just didn't like him. You don't belong in this party. You're an outsider. You never really fit, which was the same sort of feeling that Rudd's the coup against him had. But I also remember with Rudd that for the entire time until the next election with Julia Gillard, the pressure that was put on to explain it, you know, that for the reasons they mumbled and jumbled, it always came back, but you haven't explained it to the Australian people why this was the necessary manoeuvre. Mm-hmm. It seems now with the rabble of sort of prime ministers that have come and gone, you know, in these years, that nobody's even really asking that question anymore. And that Scott Morrison now, I mean, isn't even attempting it. He's just, it happened, nothing to see here, let's move on. And I find that astonishing. And if it succeeds, to the extent that people don't even ask, that they've genuinely lost interest in this turnover, then that's a sort of critical change in Australian political culture, cemented.
Yeah. Well, we've got, we're it's a real danger that we are cementing this planned obsolescence of prime ministers, for sure. It's almost hardwired into the political culture now. There are some differences, though, with this one, and God help me, I have covered everyone over the last decade. There are some differences with this one.
Which was the most fun?
Oh, God, honestly, they've not been fun for...
No, go on with the differences.
None of them have been fun. Mm. They've all been sort of gut-wrenching at different levels. They've all been, oh, God, I can't understand this proposition that's often said about political journalists are addicted to this stuff. It's like, oh, my God, seriously. But differences with this one. Well, let's look at an external marker first. This is the only leadership change involving an incumbent prime minister. Let's set aside opposition leaders for a minute. The only one involving an incumbent prime minister which has not given the government that executed it an immediate bounce in the polls. This is the only one. So I got our guys at Essential Media, who do a poll that we run fortnightly in The Guardian, to have a look at this, because I wanted to understand what had happened in the past and impose it on the current set of circumstances. And what they said to me, that basically every other leadership change involving an incumbent prime minister has given the government of the day a 2pp bounce of about 3%, thereabouts, immediate. So it's been a sort of catharsis of some type. I don't know why, but it has been. In this, it's gone in the other direction quite sharply. So that suggests to me that the Australian public may have reached a point of intolerance about the coup culture, which politicians will have to listen to and absorb. That's one thing. The other thing that's accompanied this particular leadership change, which has not been present in previous ones, although perhaps at the margins, and it goes to your point about explanation, or dare we say truth-telling, about why these things happen and the cultures that sit behind these things. And there hasn't been a lot of truth-telling. You know, the reason the Labor Party moved against Kevin Rudd in 2010, wasn't it, the first time, was that they panicked, but there was also a belief that Rudd had kind of semi-lost it. And they had to sort of assert control of the government, which was sort of drifting after this setback about climate change and other things. So there was an explanation for it, it's just they didn't share it. In this particular event, I think what we've seen is truth-telling. We've seen people come forward in their own way and try and explain to people how traumatic it is to be in the centre of one of these things. We've seen Liberal women, you know, who, you know, people covering this over the week where this escalated, I have never heard people in such a state of distress as they were, as this unfolded. Incredible state of trauma and distress. And
with some women particularly?
Women particularly, yeah. They were just trapped inside this freak show, basically. And it was all sort of unfolding. And I think Lucy Gachui said it very aptly, if any of you guys listened to her on Radio National last night, an interview she did with Patricia Karvelas, which was, you know, I think she told very truthfully what that felt like, that we were sort of being thrust into this crucible where we were asked to make a decision about something that we didn't want anything to do with, and the sort of intense psychological pressure that that places on people. And one of the things that's very underexplored in the sort of the leadership transitions of the last decade is the cumulative impact of them, that now we're sort of rolling from traumatic stress to post-traumatic stress to traumatic stress. And in a piece I did, if you don't mind, Sally, just briefly, in a piece I did for Meanjin last year about political life, where I tried to chronicle the life in a way to explain to people what is going wrong, what's happening, a fellow by the name of Mal Washer, who is a Liberal backbencher and a GP by training, said to me something really acute about the sort of disintegration of culture. He said that what has broken down over the last 10 years is the safety and sanctuary of the caucus and the party room as gathering places, collegiate gathering places. Once the leadership coup started to happen, the place went into a state of mortal combat. And when you enter a state of mortal combat, humans have physiological responses to that. And the building is in a permanent state of fight or flight as a consequence of the trauma that these people are inflicting on themselves. And when people are in a permanent state of fight or flight, you're not going to get great decision making.
Sounds so appealing, doesn't it? Well, I mean, you just can't imagine why people aren't falling over themselves to get in on it. Do you think that Scott Morrison's attempts to, you know, he said, I think today or yesterday, we're going to deal with this, but we're going to deal with it in-house. Is that going to work?
Good luck, soldier. Well, it's not so far, and nor should it, frankly. And I think Liberal women have been importantly courageous in this bout of truth-telling we've seen over the last week or so. And they haven't been chastened or bowed by being called princesses or snowflakes or precious petals or whatever the wisdom of the world wants to inflict on their stories.
Maybe this will be a good thing.
Well, hope is always dangerous. Hope is very dangerous, particularly in my line of work. And you can be stranded in your hope because I sort of said to one person in the middle of this who was shouting at me about the way I'd portrayed them in the middle of one of these sort of people running in and out of offices. This person sort of took real umbrage at how I'd portrayed them and was shouting at me. And I said, you know, well, I am hostage to your freak show. Mm. It's like, don't shout at me, mate. Mm. You know, I am hostage to your freak show. What I'm doing is trying to tell the truth as best I can in the middle of this situation that you inflict. So I don't know if we should be hopeful, but I think it is important that protagonists in the system talk about what's going on inside the system honestly. And I think that can be cathartic in some way. But whether we should be hopeful yet, I don't know.
This little book on disruption is about the disruption in your trade, mm-hmm. in journalism, and its relationship to political culture, mostly in Australia but also elsewhere, particularly America and Trump. It's very current. I'm wondering if you can take us through a bit of a forensic walk through what happened with this coup from the point of view of a journalist in your position and disruption. So if you can go back a couple of weeks to the point in which, I don't know, you answered the phone or bumped into someone and realised this is on, what that meant for you in relationship to disruption.
Do you mean in terms of work intensification or what we do? You mean
what,
the whole gamut?
You know, what happens to you in this culture now when this sort of thing happens?
All right, let's try and think about that. All right. Well, the first thing really is that that we need to point out is these things are now obviously reported live, which was not the case in the print era. And when things are reported live, they take on different dimensions. You know, we're all used to seeing sport live on television. You tune in for your footy match on the weekend or whatever else. That's all very familiar. But reporting politics live is a new phenomenon still. A developing phenomenon in this country. When you report something live, the spectacle associated with it increases. Even if you try with all of your little might to not shove coal in the coal loader and feed the spectacle, the dynamic of live reporting makes it a spectacle. An audience gathers, an audience piles in legitimately, obviously. It's great, you know, to hear the audience in the middle of these things. But there is a whole dynamic ensues associated with that, which then politicians can, of course, play. So in terms of what it means in practice, well, you know, we obviously have a live blog at The Guardian. I don't helm that anymore, but I contribute to it. And we basically run a TikTok all the way through about what's happening and why, and our best endeavours to keep that information as fast and accurate as we can. One upside, because there's a fair bit of dystopia in this conversation, but one upside, I think one thing that we're getting better at in live political reporting is understanding the potential for us to be captured by the process or played in the process. I'll give you one tangible example, if that's okay, associated with this particular leadership spill. When Kevin Rudd unseated Julia Gillard in 2013, someone will correct me if I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure it was 2013, he triggered a spill against Gillard with this notion that there was a petition circulating, right, that names were being gathered in order to unseat her. Now, no one has ever seen this petition. No one has ever cited it. And yet it was reported at the time as being a thing. This petition was circulating. Now, journalists learned something as a result of that experience.
So did the sitting Prime Minister.
Well, exactly. Mm. They learned something, but we did too. So when a petition was circulating by the Dutton forces in order to gather the 43 signatures that Malcolm Turnbull demanded as the price of his execution, much more forensic checks were made to establish that this document actually existed, that this was a thing. So we are getting a bit better institutionally at not being played quite so much, although, of course, you still get played. Another example, tangible example, again, about sort of buyer beware and what you learn as a journalist when you're reporting these things live. For example, in this leadership change posts I did on the live blog, particularly before the second spill, the one that unseated Turnbull on the Friday, what happens in those hours before a spill takes place with all the live coverage is protagonists try to create a herd dynamic, if that makes sense, by feeding information out through Sky News or through ABC 24 or through the live blogs. They try and create this sense of numbers moving in particular directions. So what I've learned, again, sadly having done all of these damn things and some of them live, many of them live, is that the information that you're given in the, say, 3 hours before the spill happens, all of it is unreliable, all of it. You believe none of it. So what I did in relation to this one quite explicitly, and I have in fact done it in the past too, is contribute posts to the live blog saying, look, this is what the protagonists are saying, but by the way, any information that you get at this stage of the news cycle is entirely unreliable. And again,
so there is no fact-checking mechanism when things are moving
at that stage, because things are moving incredibly quickly. You can read, as you know, there were signs on the Friday that Morrison was going to come up the middle, and the signs were predominantly that Malcolm Turnbull was stalling, bringing on the vote. There was this process of gathering the 43 signatures. If you guys follow this minutely, you'll know that. Then we had a subsequent process where the 43 signatures on the petition that we all saw this time, given it was a real document, unlike the last one, got walked into the Prime Minister's office. And, of course, you know, everyone staked out in the corridors seeing who's coming and going, what they're doing. Then the word came back from the PMO, oh, no, we're actually going to check these names, right? And, you know, there was sort of predictable, you know, garment rending and, oh, what an outrage. And I thought to myself, oh, okay, so Scott Morrison needs another half an hour, which obviously he did. And so they called on the spill at the exact moment when they believed that Morrison had the numbers. So there's so much sort of art in the way these things are executed, and because they're doing them so frequently, of course, they're getting better at it. But anyway,
That 12:20 party room meeting instead of midday.
No, exactly. It was it all counted
and
in the end.
And the commentators sounded so irritated.
No, I know. There was an explosion on Sky News.
On media schedule. Yeah.
I know. It was quite funny. In our office, we were laughing. There was actually an audible explosion, I think, in Sky News when the word came out that the signatures were going to be checked. But anyway, so anyway, there's all that. And what does it mean? Well, obviously we work incredibly hard. I had a weekend off this weekend. That was my first weekend off in five. You know, we work 14-hour days to bring you this coverage. Is our own judgment impaired in that degree of pressure and work intensification? Well, probably.
Not as much as theirs.
Hope not. Hope not.
These coups have only been happening in the past 10 years, precisely in the period of the disruption having, really entrenched itself. Could they even take place at all if we hadn't had the disruption in the media, if we didn't have live politics and 24-hour politics channels? I mean, is it the great enabler?
Oh, God, it's so depressing, isn't it? Yeah, to some degree it is. Obviously, look, leadership changes have occurred in the past. Obviously, it's not a function of the disrupted media environment, but it's an unavoidable coincidence, isn't it, that our entire apparatus is disrupted at the same time as theirs is, conveniently in most Western democracies where this has happened. Could this be a thing? Well, I think it's a thing. I can't give you scientific proof, but I think it's a thing. It's sitting where I sit. It feels like a thing to me. It feels like these things are intimately connected. But it's also bigger than the sort of tectonic plates of technological change and all of that sort of stuff. There is, and that's sort of what I'm trying to hark on slightly with these observations about the politics and the human condition. There is a human dimension to what's happening too, which is a bit sort of underexplored, I think, in our system. But look, this book doesn't shy away from the fact. When I wrote it, I wondered to myself in my little quiet room, what is the hardest question I can possibly ask myself as a journalist in 2018? And the hardest question I could ask myself was, are we making things worse? And the answer that I came back with was yes. So it's not a conclusion that we can or should shy away from, because from that conclusion comes a degree of self-awareness about who you are, what your mission is. It sort of distills things to their essence, I suppose. Now, it's not all our fault what's happening. It's not all our fault by any stretch. And despite all the barriers to it, great work is still being done and truth is being pursued with great vigour. But we also have to be aware that through forces that are bigger than us, we're being picked up and we're being put in another place, and I want news consumers to understand what is happening, because it's in plain sight, but for me, but not for you. So you, I think, need me to try and explain this. And so it sort of increases your degree of attentiveness to what you're reading and what you're consuming. And I hope it helps your choices about what journalism you support at a time when journalism needs your support.
There were accusations and debates and so on this time round, particularly the Stoush with Chris Uhlman, directly confronting certain media outlets and personalities about, you know, really direct involvement. Was it that new though?
No. Funnily enough, I think I said this on... No, I didn't. No, I said it to a friend of mine. I thought I said it. Might have said it on John Fain this morning. I didn't. No, at the moment I'm reading Judith Brett's absolutely impeccably wonderful biography of Alfred Deakin, and that sort of recounts in great detail the sort of relationship between Deakin and Syme, you know, the great Melbourne media mogul.
His first job.
Well, I tell you what, talk about influence. You know, what's recounted there is, you know, would sort of would make you laugh at Alan Jones or Peter Credlin, or, you know, it's just sort of absurd by way of comparison. So no, the short answer is it's not new, no, that media figures try to influence politics. In fact, you know, the sort of origins of journalism are radical pamphlets. You know, it's sort of a business of trying to influence politics and political discussion. But there are some dangers about the disrupted media environment that that I think are worth pointing out. And we did see this manifest quite obviously during this leadership challenge, where particular media commentators took very, very vociferous public positions against the Prime Minister and were gunning for him, literally. Now, some of those commentators have very small audiences, but what MPs, the dynamic that MPs were recounting to me, which gives me a degree of pause or concern, was that, you know, someone like an Alan Jones or a Peter Credlin on Sky at night time, and Jones has got a reasonable audience. Sorry, I shouldn't disdain Alan Jones's audience. Sorry, Alan, if you're listening. You do obviously have an audience, but Sky doesn't have a massive one, has a fairly boutique one. But what happens is that people who watch those shows, who tune into those particular commentators, tune in tribally, because those commentators reinforce their own views. And what happened, I know this because many, many MPs told me, was that, you know, if there was a ferocious editorial by Credlin on whatever her show's called, or Jones or whatever, the emails would start to come in to their offices. And these are from branch members. Now, you know, people who are on pre-selection panels, who do fundraising, who turn up at elections and hand out how to vote cards. You know, these are important people in political institutions and structures. And Liberal MPs were kind of getting diatribes from these people. You know, how dare you support that communist Malcolm Turnbull, and why on earth would you allow the one world government conspiracy of emissions reduction to be foisted on the Australian public? You know, like this. And it was coming in at great volumes. And so a feedback loop ensues. This sort of narrow bubble conversation happens. And MPs in that very hothouse environment then feel a lot of pressure, because they're getting nipped at their heels from people who are important to them. Now, what annoys me about this, of course, is that the voters are out of it. This has got nothing to do with the voters. This has got nothing to do with the, you know, people who turn up to vote at elections. This is a closed conversation. It's like, I think I said somewhere in a column I wrote recently, it's like politics is becoming the art of shouting in small rooms. It's like it's getting smaller and smaller, and the public are getting further and further away. And but politicians are bombarded by this sort of false signals and false information, and it's quite powerful and palpable for them.
It's interesting the way you sort of talk about the human effect on, you know, their own behaviour has on them. But you touch on in the book too that there's a human effect on society, of course, having to be on the receiving end of it. And you write that a friend of yours remarked that the sheer volume of information now pulsing through the virtual public square was triggering instinctive human responses. And I assume those responses are about sort of retreat, disengage, stick with your tribe. Mm. And that Bernard Keane, who you interviewed, backed that up and says, to quote from Bernard Keane, that the disruption isn't merely economic but psychological. We're an increasingly psychologically unmoored society. Mm. I wondered if you could talk a bit more about that effect.
Yeah. Well, there is this unmooring. There's definitely this sort of sense of being picked up and put in another place and a certain amount of confusion in the journey. And because of all of this information which we're all being bombarded by, you know, one of the big sort of challenges in digital from a commercial perspective in digital journalism is dealing with audience fatigue, because audiences have contradictory impulses. At one level, we do all this live work because audiences flock to it, massive audiences for all of these live events. At another level, though, they retreat from it and are sort of repelled by it because it's just too much. I mean, you know, a human mind can only absorb so much information. And the danger, my political mate was sort of talking about, that people get then resort back to faith propositions if they're literally being bombarded with so much material that they can't process it. Then you go back to basic faith propositions. I feel this is X, Y, or Z, or my beliefs suggest blah, 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 which is very difficult for the concept of progress, really, if there's not a sort of constituency for facts and evidence and data, and then and people are retreating to their gut feelings about things. This is difficult. This is a real slippery slope. But it's not. I mean, I wanted to obviously explain it from my own vantage point, to talk about journalism with a view to trying to make you guys attentive to what's going on and understand how it impacts you. How it impacts me is not very important. How it impacts you is massively important. So that's the purpose of the exercise. But it's cultural, it's huge what's happening. And it's not, and disruption obviously is not limited to journalism. I mean, every profession, everybody sitting out here would have a disruption story about what technology has done or other inputs have done to your own occupations and how all of that's changing. Now, we're all going through that together, and we're going through it, you know, with these devices that are highly addictive and completely ruin your concentration span, and all of this sort of stuff is happening all at once. So it's, again, I mean, I don't have any, you know, sort of fabulous easy answer to these things, but it's understanding that these things are all connected and trying to sort of make those connections.
You ask in the book, did we, the disrupted media, somehow create Trump?
Yeah.
And talk us through your answer.
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. Well, not entirely, again. Trump is a multifactorial story. And the danger, too, of sitting up here, and I think I say it in the book, is, you know, you put a couple of journos together and then a deep solipsism happens where we somehow think we're, you know, creating everything, which is obviously ridiculous. Trump was elected for a variety of reasons, not just as a consequence of a disrupted media environment. What's kind of complex in Australia, or difficult for Australians to grasp, I think, is because we didn't have a deep recession after the global financial crisis in the way that they did in the States and in the UK and in continental Europe. We dodged that bullet. So the biggest economic shock since the Great Depression has occurred everywhere pretty much in the world except here. And politics is changing as a result, as it did after the Great Depression. You know, we're seeing those sorts of very dramatic pull factors working through politics everywhere. So Donald Trump's, the election of Donald Trump is a story about what you can do in a voluntary voting system, what you do at a time where you're at the tail end of a massive economic dislocation in a country where there's not the same social contract between governments and voters as there is in this country, fortunately. You know, a lot of Americans had been through this enormous economic shock with no help from their government. So you wonder why people are angry.
But also, a candidate that just plays the media.
Well, that's, yes. No, no, sorry, I'm not letting us off the hook, Sally. No, I'm not. I'm getting to us.
A candidate that, as you say, turns crisis after crisis in the media somehow to his own advantage.
Yeah, into currency. It's quite extraordinary. He is a master at playing the disrupted media environment and playing us at our own game. You know, journalists are motivated, many of us, by a desire, a deep desire, to record what happens. You know, we get the first go at history and we take that imperative very seriously. So we try and bear witness is what we do. We try and bear witness to events and record them as accurately as we can. When powerful people speak, like a presidential aspirant or a president, we feel obliged to report what they say. That's the job. So a figure like Trump understands that and understands that in the cacophonous, disrupted media environment, it's very, very, very easy to create a wind tunnel into which you can shout almost unimpeded. And this guy is a master at it, like master, absolute master, and understands it by intuition. He doesn't have to have a flotilla of smart media characters around him, spin doctors and other people telling him how to ride this roller coaster. He is this roller coaster. He embodies it and he knows how to operate inside it. So it's a diabolical problem for journalists and American journalists. I look at colleagues in the US and think, my God, how on earth are you doing this? It's so difficult because everything bounces off him. He plays by different rules. He disdains facts and evidence. He doesn't think those things apply to him. He just continues to talk. And the environment allows his message to be carried about on the winds. And what we do about it, I wish I had an easy answer.
Well, yeah, I mean, the mainstream, some of the great institutions of American media are obviously clueless. David Remnick just today in the New Yorker uninviting...
Yeah,
Steve Bannon, it was just a sort of remarkable sort of series of decisions, wasn't it, that I suspect won't play out very well for him.
Well, I think that was a very poor decision. I really do. I think, you know, I've been out, for those of you who follow me on social media today, you may realise that I've had an absolute caning on social media today for saying that David Remnick made the wrong decision by disinviting Steve Bannon from, the New Yorkers Ideas Festival. And, I mean, obviously you can argue this both ways, but it's sort of, you know, Bannon is a person of influence. The ideas that he propagates are complete crap. They are absolute monumental garbage. And these guys get an open microphone either through their own platforms or by self-publishing. They face very few obstacles between them and an audience. If I can place an obstacle between a charlatan and an audience, then I will elect to do that. And, you know, I had people saying to me today, oh, well, you know, why give the you know, Nazi sympathiser a platform? Well, it's not about giving him a platform. It's about imposing some accountability. It's about, you know, not handing someone an open communications channel. Like, for instance, Sarah Ferguson, if you guys watched her interview last night on Four Corners, I think the triumph, actually, of that interview, from my perspective, was that Sarah, you know, sort of... Bannon says, it's not about race, it's about economics, right? Well, that's rubbish, obviously, but partly it is about economics. So Sarah said to him, OK, it's about economics, so explain how your program benefits working Americans. That guy has nothing to say that makes any sense. He basically said, oh, well, we've got to disrupt the global order and that, yeah, maybe a recession happens and, oh, that's unfortunate, but anyway, we will move on. What? Excuse me? This guy is basically saying to people, OK, well, my prescription for you know, the economic nationalism, lower economic growth, which hurts working people, higher consumer prices by the application of tariff protection and other measures to make consumer goods in America more expensive for people who consume them. This guy is an absolute charlatan. And Sarah actually got him to articulate his economic program, which makes no sense. And I haven't seen that very much, frankly. So if I can put that guy on a platform with someone like David Remnick, who will ask him questions about his program and not rise to the bait of his nonsense, well, then I'm all for it. That is the essence of what I do. Like, if I had to distill it down to a sentence, what I think I do as a journalist is stand between you and a charlatan. That's my job. So, you know, I think Remnick made the wrong decision.
The tribalism that's become a commodity for politicians, it's also the same for media too, isn't it? And so your argument too is about breaking out of that tribalism and not always playing to the tune of your sort of known readership.
Yeah, exactly. And again, I think people need to be a little bit aware of this. Obviously, when the internet disrupted our business models, this is an existential challenge for journalism. Journalism doesn't happen as a public good. It doesn't just fall out of the sky or is always a thing just because it's been there for a couple of centuries. It only happens if people pay for it. That's it. Otherwise, it doesn't happen. It's not something that's sort of built into the institutions of our democracies. It's a function of having someone pay for it. That's it. So we've had this period of disruption. All our business models have gone to pot in commercial media. There's all this radical, fascinating, rich, interesting experimentation going on at the moment about how we rebuild our business models in this disrupted environment. But what a lot of media companies are doing is looking for engagement from their readers. They are looking for an emotional connection between them and their audiences. They're looking to rouse emotion. Because if you rouse emotion, then people might pay for what you do. They might have a tangible connection with you and pay for what you do. And look, that's fine. And I'm massively into audience, you know, audience-centred journalism. Like, that's what I am about. But there are some dangers in the environment too of people, these sort of enclaves forming with people only talking to people with whom they agree. And not connecting in the middle to try and have respectful disagreement between points of view that don't intersect. I mean, that's the fundamentals of democracy. Like, again, like a political scientist will tell you, what's democracy? It's synthesizing conflict without resort to violence, right? That's what democracy is. And media culture, I think, needs to reflect that, where people of different views have respectful conversations with one another. Honestly, I look at the media environment at the moment with people in enclaves not talking to one another, and that chills me, frankly, as a citizen. It really does, because we need people to be talking to one another whether they agree with what's being said or not. It's like a muscle memory. It's really important. It really goes to the essence of what a liberal, vibrant liberal democracy is. So again, I hate that tribalism. I hate that hyperpartisanship. I hate that sense of you're with me or against me. It's dumb, and it's dulling to the public conversation. And these are serious times we're living in. These are really serious times in politics all around the world. Like, really fundamental things are up for grabs at this point in time. And I don't think we should be dumbed down or dulled into thinking that we can only speak to people with whom we agree.
If you would like to ask a question now, is the time to put your hand up and...
Thank you, Catherine. I appreciate your work. And a couple of points just on... with the kind of politics, people are becoming disillusioned. Hence, like when I started doing politics back in the 80s, there like was 80% of people were either Liberal or Labor, and now it's dropping down. If you use the South Australian Senate election, it was like 65% for the major parties or whatever.
Yeah.
So when are the parties going to realise that they are not selling to what they... because then you, like, the left is now kind of split between the Greens and the Labor Party, and the Liberals was, or the right was split between the Nationals and the Liberals, and and now they've kind of got the Australian Conservatives and whoever else, and now the Greens on the...
Yep.
And it's just a kind of... The parties kind of think they can do the same thing, and if they talk to the same audiences, like... like Peter Dutton said, he's dead to you guys and the ABC. But when if they get more challenging questions, hopefully they can formulate their own opinion, and therefore, you know, express it in a better way. So hopefully it's more convincing rather than...
Let's let Catherine respond. Thank you.
Thank you for that question. I think I suppose one word of reassurance. I think they are aware. I don't think they're unaware of what's happening, even though there may be not many external manifestations of their awareness. They may be presenting to voters as entirely unself-aware, but I think they are desperately aware of what's happening. It's an environment of disruptors. You know, that's what this environment encourages, and we're seeing disruptors all over the political landscape. And the hegemony of the major parties is declining, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, although the major party system in Australia has been a great force of institutional stability. But one of the real incomprehensible things about the coup culture in the major parties is that they are discounting their own stability premium. That is what used to distinguish major parties from disruptors. That here we are, these great sort of institutional edifices, you know, steaming along with all this history and all that sort of jazz. We are the forces of stability in the political system. Well, no, you're not. Not when you chuck leaders out the door like that. You know, there's so much confetti. So they get it. They understand that they're in this fight against disruptors. They understand that they're doing themselves in, yet they do themselves in anyway. So how does the story end? Well, hopefully, you know, with human voices waking them. Hopefully.
But what does that look like? A lot of independence?
A lot of independence, yeah. And perhaps, you know, Australia is drifting towards an experimentation of, you know, European-style coalition, permanent coalition governments. As a consequence of that breakdown in the stability that the major parties offer. Perhaps I still think in Australia we're going to see shellackings, right? We're going to see big election results where one side definitively wins and the other one doesn't, because I think there are just periods in the cycle where that happens. But we seem to have settled in the political system over the last 10 years or so into very close results sometimes. And, you know, rise of more independence. So that's changing the nature of the political landscape, and it's sort of a story still in transition, so it's a bit hard to tell you how it ends. But if you don't like what you see, you know, the simple antidote is get active and tell your politicians that it's a bunch of crap and you've had enough.
Yeah, but, I mean, people are saying that, aren't they? They're screaming it at every opportunity and they're just not... They're not listening.
They are listening. They get it. It's just there are forces. I'm not trying to portray them as sort of innocent victims, you know, in some crime that's been perpetrated against them. That's obviously patently absurd. But there's sort of big forces at play upon them, and there are also deep human dimensions to what's going on as well. And humans are, let's face it, contradictory, sort of quixotic creatures. You know, we're not always, you know, it's not always linear. We don't always make brilliant decisions, particularly not under duress. So, you know, it's not that they're not listening. They get it, but it's just that they sort of seem locked in a cycle that they can't yet sort of create an end to, if that makes sense. It's weird.
Oh, hello.
I was really disappointed that poor old Julie Bishop got a real bad deal. And I was even more disappointed that journalists didn't jump up and down and start writing, that there weren't more opinion pieces and more questions asked. Mm-hmm. 50% of the voters are women.
Yeah, more, I think.
Oh, well, you know, more or less.
I think slightly more, anyway.
And yet everyone just said, oh, well. And there wasn't any big carry on. And I was really disappointed that journalists didn't jump up and down and start asking some real serious questions here.
Mm. Thank you for that. It's an interesting point that you raise. I think part of the dynamic with Bishop in this three-way contest, though, was let's take gender out of it for a minute. I'll put gender back in, but let's just take that out for a minute. I think the view of the moderates that ended up rallying for Morrison after Turnbull was deemed terminal, I think in their minds, in the minds of quite senior people, Bishop running in that three-way race was unhelpful in the sense that she may finish in a three-way ballot. Hopefully this will make sense to you. She may finish ahead of Morrison in a three-way ballot, which would then turn into a two-way ballot between Dutton and Bishop, and that Conservatives in the government would not vote for Bishop under any circumstances. And that would project Peter Dutton into the Prime Ministership. So that, just set gender over there just for a sec, right? And this may explain why there wasn't more outrage about it. That was a calculation that moderates made, rightly or wrongly. I'd happen to think they're probably right, that's probably what would have happened given the antipathy of Conservatives in the Liberal Party towards Julie Bishop. I suspect that's what would have happened. So in a way that would have infected some of the coverage of it because we were looking at this three-way race and we've also had a bit of experience in three-way races sometimes in these things and how they end up. Now, putting gender back into it, well, yeah, obviously Julie Bishop, in every piece of polling data that I've seen, was always ranked second after Turnbull as the Liberal Party's best asset in terms of popularity, public recognition, people knew who she was. She was visible. She was viewed as competent and charismatic and all of those things. Now, why won't the Liberal Party elect a competent, charismatic woman as a leader? Well, that's a very big question, isn't it? And it's one that I think, interestingly, she's chosen to throw in their face by remaining at her post. And that, as an act of defiance, tells you a little bit of something about where the heads of women in the Liberal Party are right at the present time. So I think... Again, I don't know whether Bishop will stay long-term or not or drift off into a diplomatic appointment or whatever it is, but I think she's been gutsy and also I think she's made her own little political protest, which is really fascinating.
The optics, if it's a bloke pre-selected for Wentworth... won't be easy, will they?
I'm dying to see this Liberal bloke, you know, go onto the hustings in Wentworth, you know, telling the good voters of Wentworth, you know, that they're part of a government that has no policy on climate change. Mm. Good luck in Wentworth, kids.
Thank you for a scintillating exchange.
Gracious.
For me, the big elephant in the room is the one you've just mentioned. Gender's crucial. But what could you say more about how it's all playing out for climate change across the merry-go-round, 10 years of merry-go-round?
Oh, you wanted to really depress me, didn't you? Oh, God. Well, not well at this point. Unless the Liberal Party can get its act together and stop being convulsed by voodoo in relation to this issue, then we have a real problem in this country now. We have a party of government unable to face up to the science of climate change. And what does that mean in practice? Well, what that means in practice is the country is locked into cycles where progressive governments take the reins in Canberra, get stuff done, like the amazing feat of legislating a carbon price in a minority parliament, get it done, get it implemented, get it legislated, action happens, then their opponents get elected and all of it gets dismantled. And we have got no time to waste. So this is, like, this was the sort of casualty of, you know, leadership drama, you know, version 389, was that something quite big happened in the last fortnight, and that there is a sense now, I mean, there's sort of been this 10-year objective in Australian politics that we started with bipartisanship on climate change at the late end of John Howard when he proposed emissions trading, which was picked up by Kevin Rudd. There was this period of bipartisanship. It fractured when Tony Abbott wanted to drive Malcolm Turnbull out of the Liberal leadership, and it's
well,
been...
Well, it also fractured when the Greens didn't support it. Oh. I mean, oh. That was the moment, wasn't it? Let's not
forget. Let's not forget. Mm. Let's not forget. So
that actually wasn't Tony Abbott's fault.
No, that wasn't Tony Abbott's fault. No. There's sort of, we've had this industry in this country of making the perfect the enemy of the good. And I saw it again, to my enormous frustration, through all the debate about the National Energy Guarantee. It's like, you got to be kidding me. We're doing this again. And every new recruit into this process, either as a influencer, you know, someone on the margins of the debate, you know, or protagonists inside, what have got to be re-educated in how stupid this is, time after time after time. Look, I mean, I'm showing my age and my impatience, but I mean, oh, you got to be kidding me. So again, we are in this ridiculous position right now where ostensibly the Morrison government has committed or intends to remain in the Paris Agreement, and we have no, when I say no, I mean underline, zip, zero, none, policy in order to get us there. The only sector of the economy where emissions are currently falling is electricity. Every other sector of the economy, they are rising. They're not falling because there's no reason for them not to rise. And this is... from the point of view of certainty, from the point of view of rational action, from the point of view of, you know, we have a great challenge in this country at the moment, which is to take a, you know, an economy which we have one of the highest, you know, emissions per capita in the world, an economy that's structured on resources and coal, and we have a very, very short time to transform that economy into the necessity of a decarbonised world. And in this country, we have been good at economic transformation. That is what we are good at. And for a problem as profound as this one, we are failing in the face of this challenge over and over again. So I'd like to bring you good news, but I have none. Sorry.
We'll take one more. We'll have to be brief and we'll just try our luck whether or not we can end on a happy note. No pressure.
Give us something to be happy about. Go on.
I don't think it's going to be happy.
Oh, dear.
I just like your comment on Karen Middleton's article in Saturday Paper saying that Scott Morrison, this was all engineered and he was plotting this for quite some time. I found it incredibly dispiriting. What's your opinion?
Well, Karen's a really good journalist and that was a very forensically reported piece. Myself, I think it's more complicated than Morrison's kind of pulling a crouching tiger, hidden dragon. You've sort of got to look at it from the point of view of that sort of that story I tried to tell you at the beginning, that there has been this sort of sotto voce conversation within the government really since the start of the year about whether Turnbull would make the end of the year. Everybody inside the government understands that conversation was happening. Anybody with any ambition would be factoring in their own role in, you know, how various cards might fall, if that makes sense. Julie Bishop was, obviously, Morrison was, Dutton was, Abbott is. You know, you'd be nuts if you weren't wargaming your own position in the firmament when things are kind of unstable in the way that they were. But I just think it's a bit... Journalists, we look for kind of satisfying narratives, right, after these things are done. We look to try and impose order on chaos, and that sometimes involves storytelling. You know, there's a sort of compelling story. Okay, Morrison was actually going, you know, doing Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon the whole time. I just think things are always more complicated than that, that's all. I'm not suggesting it wasn't happening, and there's plenty of people around the place who are convinced that Morrison was kind of doing the double game all along. And that may be true, but I think it's sometimes difficult to separate contingency planning from actual front-stabbing stroke backstabbing. And also the thing is, after the fact and even during the fact, all of these jokers, all of their accounts are unreliable. That's the problem. And there's so much, you know, like the winners write the history, right? There's so much people reposition, you know, and I've seen this just as an observable reality as a journalist. You know, a politician can tell you one story 2 weeks ago and then another story 3 weeks hence, right? It's like, you know, things sort of assume a certainty that they don't have, if that makes sense. But I mean, look, he put himself on the grid. He and Dutton put themselves on the grid at the same time. You know, I can't remember exactly when the occasion was, but it was a few months ago, where they, I don't know, government must have had a shocking week, and they were both asked, did they ever want to leave the Liberal Party? And both of them said yes. So again, he's no saint, he's no humanitarian, just saying kumbaya, Malcolm, you know, gosh, how's your father? But whether he was sort of an evil genius, you know, sort of clapping his hands behind the scenes and running the whole play, well, I'm not convinced.
Catherine Murphy and Sally Warhaft in front of a live audience at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne. If you're interested in hearing more about media and politics in Australia, we've got plenty more from the Fifth Estate and beyond at wheelercentre.com. We'll return very soon. Until then, take care.